Section 3. Epistles from the Pillars? As I explained in Chapter 7, we cannot count as evidence any forgeries or demonstrable interpolations among the epistles. Fabricated evidence of historicity is not evidence of historicity. Although if forgeries or other epistles let slip evidence of non-historicity, that can be telling, and a few examples of that can be found. The epistles of James and 1 Peter are also oddly silent about a historical Jesus, an oddity later rectified by the forgery of a second letter from Peter, as I noted in Chapter 8, and perhaps by the forgery of the epistles of John, since 1 John 1 verses 1 to 3 seems to serve a similar purpose as 2 Peter 1 verse 16 to 2 verse 1. Indeed, it even appears to protest too much. Thus were produced letters from all three of the pillars, and indeed, these letters were arranged in the New Testament in the same unusual order as Paul names them in Galatians 2 verse 9, placing Peter not first or last, but between the brothers James and John. And the number of letters from each counts up to 3, one from James, two from Peter, three from John, an obvious contrivance. Following them is the Epistle of Jude, literally Judas, which also makes no reference to the historical Jesus, not even to claim the author was his brother, despite introducing himself in Jude 1 as the brother of James. Notably, Jude concurs with 1 Clement, as I noted in Chapter 8, in suggesting that the words of Jesus only came to be communicated to the world through the apostles, Jude 17, making no mention of disciples or of Jesus having preached to the public. The Epistle of James makes no mention of its author being the brother of Jesus either. Instead, James 5 verse 11 imagines that, if referring to Jesus and not Job, that all Christians have seen Jesus die, just like Clement did, and implies Jesus has never been on earth before. He will only one day come, James 5 verses 7 to 8. James does not say Jesus is returning or coming a second time. Such a specific notion is never found in the letters of Paul either. On something close in Hebrews, I'll discuss later. It thus appears that as far as this author knew, Jesus hadn't yet been on earth at all. This James also says things that later appear on the lips of Jesus in the Gospels, yet were clearly not the words of Jesus when James wrote them. James Tabor, in the Jesus dynasty, of course, implausibly assumes James lifted these things from Jesus, even though there is no evidence of that, and it's contrary to logic to think he would pass off the words of Jesus as his own and not even mention the authority behind them. And he also argues this James is Jesus' brother, even though James conspicuously does not say this in his letter's introduction, or surely he would mention it, thus exemplifying the unreasonable lengths scholars will go to in order to fabricate entire pet histories for a non-existent Jesus, a point I already made from the example of Chilton in Chapter 2. To the contrary, it's clear that sayings of Jesus were lifted from the words of James and passed off as the words of Jesus. So the sequence of events is again reversed. Sayings came to be invented for Jesus by adapting sayings from common lore, lost scriptures, and even the apostles themselves, real or fictional. James was also written by someone defending a Torah-observant sect of Christianity, the original sect, before Paul's innovation, as noted in Element 20. Exactly as Paul implies James the Pillar had done in Galatians 2 verses 9 to 12, this letter might thus be an authentic letter from the original actual James, who was not the brother of Jesus, but of the other pillar, John, as, for example, claimed in Mark 5 verse 37. That this letter looks more in agreement with minimal mythicism than minimal historicity is therefore noteworthy. 1 Peter looks similarly curious. This might originally have been two letters, the first ending at 4 verse 11, and the second picking up at 4 verse 12 in mid-letter, its original introduction having been deleted. Also, 1 Peter 5 verse 12 says he, quote, wrote in only a few words, end quote, which he sent in the care of Silvanus, who is not mentioned in the introduction at 1 Peter 1 verse 1. Such a remark would not describe the whole letter as we have it, which is much longer than average letters in antiquity, and thus in no sense a few words, but would be explicable if it referred to the much shorter letter of 1 Peter 4 verse 12 to 1 Peter 5 verse 20, which is indeed oddly brief enough to apologize for, even if a few verses are now missing. Notably, we have no reference to Peter in this second letter, so it's possible that it was not originally a letter of Peter's and only came to be attached to Peter's epistle of 1 Peter 1 verse 1 to 1 Peter 4 verse 11 because it sounded a similar theme. But whatever the case, I shall speak of this as a single letter attributed to Peter. We know this was written by a different author than 2 Peter. Their style is too divergent. Could it have been written by the actual Peter himself? We cannot know for sure. Arguments to the contrary are not well-founded, as I explained in chapter 7. But it's noteworthy again that knowledge of a historical Jesus is conspicuously absent in 1 Peter. The author only describes himself as an apostle, not a disciple, 1 Peter 1 verse 1, which 2 Peter 1 verse 1 emulates. 1 Peter 1 verses 10 to 12 describes the actual process by which facts about Jesus were discovered, Scripture in verses 10 to 11, and revelation to the apostles in verse 12. Jesus having ministered to the public and been known to anyone in person is again conspicuously absent here. This is practically minimal mythicism in a nutshell. Nor is Jesus ever quoted in this letter, not even to back anything it argues, even though it contains an extended summary of moral advice. Instead, Peter's knowledge comes only from Scripture. For example, 1 Peter 2 verse 6 to 8, which he frequently cites to back what he says, for example, 1 Peter 3 verses 8 to 12, where Jesus' teachings on the golden rule and turning the other cheek are directly on point, yet strangely not mentioned. We get instead just a quotation from the Psalms. Nor is any event in Jesus' life brought up as an example or encouragement, other than the mere fact of his suffering death, and that only in vague terms. For example, this letter mentions Jesus having shed his blood as ransom for all, 1 Peter 1 verses 18 to 19, and being resurrected by God, 1 verse 21. But those are facts already expected on minimal mythicism. In contrast, it mentions Jesus as having appeared only in a manifestation, phanerao, hence by revelation, 1 Peter 1 verse 20, rather than as a man born and lived or chosen from among men, which is not a remark we expect on minimal historicity. This letter also says Jesus will actually visit us only in the future, as if he had not done so before, chapter 2, verse 12. It then says Jesus suffered, and his enduring that suffering is an example we are to follow when persecuted, chapter 2, verse 21, concluding the argument of chapter 2, verses 13 to 20, also chapter 4, verse 13. And that part of what he endured was being abused without speaking or fighting back, chapter 2, verse 23, and being crucified, chapter 2, verse 24. But it also cites no authority for these facts but Scripture. In fact, all Peter does here is quote and paraphrase material in Isaiah 53, directly quoting Isaiah 53, verse 9, in chapter 2, verse 22, and then paraphrasing Isaiah 53, verse 7, in chapter 2, verse 23, and Isaiah 53, verse 4, and 53, verse 11, in chapter 2, verse 24, and Isaiah 53, verse 6, in chapter 2, verse 25. Thus, even the part about Jesus not speaking or fighting back is a lift from Isaiah. There is no mention here of anyone having seen Jesus do any of this, or how Peter knows he did, or who the Lord's abusers were. Rather, it appears this information had simply been learned from Scripture, just as suggested in element 17. There evidently was no actual witness to quote other than Isaiah. Equally strange is the fact that when Peter insists all earthly authorities are, quote, sent by God for the punishment of evildoers, end quote, and thus are always to be obeyed, 1 Peter 2 verses 13 to 14, he seems to have no idea that it's these same earthly authorities who killed Jesus, who, in Peter's view, could hardly have been an evildoer. We're likewise told that Jesus preached to infernal spirits, 1 Peter 3, verses 19 to 20, after being resurrected, chapter 3, verses 18 to 19 and 21. But curiously, we're never told that he preached to men on earth before that. All we hear about is a celestial Jesus who suffers and dies in some sense in the flesh, descends to preach to imprisoned spirits, including the spirits of the dead, and then ascends back to heaven once he is put in charge of the universe. The actual process of descending and ascending is, however, not explicit here. We're only told Jesus went to preach to imprisoned spirits after his death, so the location of these spirits in relation to where Jesus started and ended up may be debatable, but background knowledge, elements 34 through 38, and evidence in Paul, Philippians 2, see also element 10, make some kind of descent and ascent most probable. This is all in agreement with minimal mythicism, and in fact, sounds a lot like the ascension of Isaiah and the Ignatian mini-gospel, as we discussed in chapter 8. So when at last Peter tells us he was a witness of the sufferings of Christ, 1 Peter 5 verse 1, possibly in what was originally a separate letter, possibly not even by Peter, we must either convict the Gospels of lying, as in their accounts Peter is not present at the crucifixion, or conclude he means by revelation, the very way Paul saw Jesus offering the bread and cup in 1 Corinthians 11 verses 23 to 25, or the way James might have said all Christians saw Jesus suffer in James 5 verse 11. I think the latter is more likely regardless, and at worst is no less likely. For as we saw, Peter could only quote and paraphrase Isaiah for details of Christ's suffering rather than recalling what he witnessed, as we'd otherwise expect. Even his vision must therefore have been vague on such details. The content of even these epistles, therefore, is less probable on the hypothesis of minimal historicity than on the hypothesis of minimal myth. So these also count as evidence for minimal mythicism and against historicity. They were simply co-opted by the historicizing sect because they said nothing overtly contrary to their aims and thus could be interpreted as being in agreement with them, even though we can see this agreement is strained and requires arbitrary dogmatic assumptions to maintain. In all honesty, I cannot fathom the content of James, Jude, and 1 Peter being even 60% likely on minimal historicity, while it's not at all unexpected on minimal myth. However, arguing a fortiori, I shall say it cannot reasonably be more than 80% likely. Meanwhile, I shall not count here the fact that some of the forged epistles in the New Testament show a reaction against mythical Jesuses as evidence for either theory, since that evidence is consistent with both. But it does refute the claim that we should have had some such evidence, yet don't, because we do. In fact, even more than we might have expected. I discuss this evidence again in chapter 8.